This talk was given by Jeffrey Shugen Arnold Roshi at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugen Roshi is the abbot of the monastery and the Zen Center of New York City. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or to find out more about our retreats and residency programs, visit us online at zmm.org. Thanks for listening.
This is from the Gateless Gate. Case 29, neither the wind nor the flag, the main case. The wind was flapping a temple flag. Two monastics were arguing about it. One said the flag was moving. The other said the wind was moving. Arguing back and forth, they could come to no agreement. The sixth ancestor said, "It is neither the wind nor the flag that is moving. It is your mind that is moving." The two monastics were struck with awe. The commentary. It is neither the wind, nor the flag, nor the mind that is moving. Where do you see the heart of the ancestor? If you can see clearly, you'll know that the two monastics obtained gold intending to buy iron. Also, you'll know that the ancestor could not repress his compassion and made an awkward scene. The poem. The wind moves, the flag moves, the mind moves. All of them have missed it. Though he knows how to open his mouth, he doesn't see he was caught by words. So over the past few weeks, I've been talking about transmission and using these few koans that in which Huainong, the sixth ancestor, figures as a way of talking about that transmission. So when we talk about transmitting the Dharma, I've spoken of it as in terms of the continuation of Buddha Dharma, or rather the teaching and practice of Buddha Dharma through successive generations. This is how it has come down to us, not through books, monasteries, institutions, degrees, but by the elusive, it would seem, transmission of something between teacher and disciple. I've also spoken of it in terms of that which is happening every day and every moment when we are intimately practicing the Dharma. It is, at its essence, that which cannot be touched or spoken or compared with something else or known. It is something that is realized beyond touching, beyond speaking, beyond judging, beyond knowing. The Buddha said it is subtle and profound and cannot be known, grasped with the senses. And so to think of this, that which we are doing within this time and culture where it seems almost everything is to be weighed and measured, sold to the highest bidder, valued for what it can accomplish, used to raise a status or to bring about some power. But ours is an inward path. This transmission of light, which is for those who are weary of samsara, and samsara is a weary-making thing. It is exhausting. We think of how we have used the earth to extract, right, all of its ancient qualities, material qualities to create so many things for ourselves. But samsara is like extracting our essential life force. So it's for those who are weary of samsara and the endless turning. And because it is such a system, samsara, it does require moment to moment, day to day, face to face, mind to mind, heart to heart, Buddha to Buddha, training, which is always taking place within a time and place and is always pointing us beyond that time and place. It brings us squarely into our thoughts and memories and anticipations and emotions and sensations so that we can begin to be free within all of those. In the fascicle I've been drawing from Menzon, the Dogen said, the great master Shakyamuni entrusted the Dharma to Mahakashyapa at the assembly on Vulture Peak. It was then authentically transmitted from ancestor to ancestor down to the venerable Bodhidharma. Bodhidharma went to China, entrusted the Dharma to the great master Hueka. This was the beginning of Dharma transmission in the eastern country. In this way, by direct transmission, it reached Huainong, the sixth ancestor. Then the authentic Buddha Dharma spread in China, and the teaching that is not concerned with concepts and theories took form. So he's referring to the Zen tradition, but he also acknowledges in other times that Zen is an expedient means. All schools, all lineages are expedient means because there is one Dharma. Concepts and theories. Well, Buddha has its own constellation of these, to be sure. They are impressive and daunting. And they are all for one singular purpose, for liberating our minds and bodies. That's it. When they become something else, when they become for some other purpose, then they are sort of moving off in their own direction, or the direction of the driver. Within the practice and the bodhicitta of Buddha Dharma, they have just one purpose. That is their purpose. Which really means, are we using them for that purpose? Not concerned, Dogen says, the teaching that is not concerned with concepts and theories. To me, not concerned means having the right concern and knowing how to have it, having the right understanding and knowing how to have right understanding. What does that mean, to have it? In a way, it begins with understanding what our concerns are, whether they're important concerns to have, because every concern we have is a devotion of energy, of attention, of focus, of our own minerals being extracted. Dogen said, long ago in the midnight on Mount Huangmei, the robe Dharma of the Buddha was authentically transmitted to the top of Huainong's head. I wondered if he was invoking how we put the okeso, the raksu, on top of our heads when we chant, which is a very intimate experience, right? On the head crown. He says, this is indeed an authentic transmission of transmitting the Dharma and the robe. This took place because Hongren, who was Huainong's teacher, knew who the true person was. Know that the air-to-air practice of Buddha ancestors, knowing a person and knowing the self, does not lie in a fathomable place. It does not lie in the place of measuring and comparing and weighing and so on. Though he says, this took place because Hongren knew who the true person was. When we see the true person once, then we see it everywhere. That's why Bodhidharma said, when something, before we have good understanding, so many things appear false that are in fact true. And that when we gain more understanding, so many things that we thought were false, now we see as true. Did I say that right? In the beginning, things that we thought that we look at and see as false are true. Afterwards, things that we look at and see and thought were false, now we see as true. Did I say it wrong again? Well, you know what I mean. If I say it again, I'll have learned it that way. and I'll never be able to say it again. So, and so we sit on the seat of mindfulness, we practice compassion, we develop samadhi, our concentration, we generate loving kindness, we gain insight, we awaken, we discover the true peace to heal the great illness of our dividing, of our distancing, of our making rigid, of our falsifying tendencies. That illness is that when we see things as they appear, we get entangled in them. That when we experience something that seems to be over there, even if it's within our own being, it's still, we see it as being over there. And in that, there's a sense that we are having some objective experience of an objective reality that is out there, and that my mind has little part in it other than to open my eyes and see it. And in that, subtly below, in the inner workings, below, for the most part, our consciousness, we are in the process of creating a sense of a soul or an essence or something permanent, something that's autonomous. And in that, what history shows us is we will not find freedom. And we will have a strong inclination towards harm. This koan is drawing from the Platform Sutra, the Sutra of Hui Nong, which is not technically a sutra because it's clearly not even being purported to have been taught by the Buddha. But in the Mahayana tradition, any teaching by any teacher at any time that is teaching true Dharma could be considered a sutra in the sense that it is being taught by Buddha mind. In the early records that are sort of laying out Huenong's life, it said that after he received the transmission from Hongren, which we looked at earlier, and then he was asked by his teacher to disappear for some period of time into the mountains, and he was chased by Monk Ming, who wanted the robe and bowl, and we looked at that. And then now he has been traveling and hiding out for a while, nurturing the sacred fetus. And he arrives at a temple where there's an abbot who's teaching. And it says, here he found shelter under the eaves. And one evening when the wind was stirring the temple banner, he heard two monastics arguing. One said it was the flag that was moving. The other said it was what the wind. Back and forth they argued, but they could not realize the true principle. And Huenong steps out of the shadows and says, pardon a common layperson for intruding into your lofty discussion, but it is neither the banner nor the wind that is moving. It is only your own mind that moves. And it's said that when the abbot heard this recounted by the two monastics, that his flesh crept at the strangeness of it. He was affected. And so the next day, he invited Huenong into his room and asked him all of these questions. And in Huenong's ability to respond to his questions, he says, you are no ordinary person. Who is your teacher? And so Huenong reveals to him that he's the sixth ancestor. And so he calls the assembly and says, this is the abbot speaking, says, I'm just a common priest who has received the precepts, but now let us meet a living bodhisattva. And so he introduces Huenong and asks him to teach. And so this is in the story of the sixth ancestor, how he begins to emerge. And so he sees these two monastics arguing back and forth about the flag. Is it the wind that's moving? Is it the flag that's moving? They cannot agree. He said, it is neither the flag nor the wind, it is your mind. Now, why does this matter? Right? This is something we can all imagine being in the middle of, having that argument, walking by and hearing it. We can all imagine walking by and seeing a flag flap in the wind. We've all seen that. And how many of us have wondered this question? to see the Dharma in every action, in every encounter, to not just pass by, is to really have faith. It is being revealed all the time. And then in essence, what Huinong is, part of what he's transmitting to us, to these two students, is the great inquiry, wanting to understand. And when we want to understand, we tend to look for, when we want to understand something that is we recognize as a great matter, we tend to look for something great, profound, that has sort of all the markings of being profound. Something that stands out, that gets our attention and says, I am profound. Look here. And then we miss thousands, millions, billions of moments in which there's a question. I open my eyes, I see there's movement. From that place of samsara, it just all seems self-evident. The flag is, the wind is blowing, the flag is moving. I see it, it's all objective, it's happening over there. I'm just observing something that's happening. I have no part in this. I'm not the flag, I'm not the wind, I'm not the movement. What more is there? If it was just an objective awareness, if you are just a neutral observer, then why is there so much disagreement and arguing and fighting about that flag that's waving in the wind? And just replace the flag with whatever you want that people are arguing about that is flapping in the wind. I saw a bumper sticker yesterday, or the other day, when I was pulling into somewhere to park, the bumper sticker said, I could be wrong. And I thought, yeah. Hell yeah, damn right. I could be wrong. And I thought, what a great thing at this time for us to acknowledge. Oh, by the way, right after we've so righteously argued our opinion. Oh, by the way, oh yeah, I could be actually be wrong. I could actually not know what I'm talking about. I could not be seeing this clearly. So we, in the Zen tradition, we talk about having great faith in the Dharma, in the Buddhas, in the enlightened mind, in your Buddha nature, your capacity, your practice. And that is balanced with great doubt, doubt in samsara, doubt in things as they appear to be, doubting in our habitual cycles, our false views, the views we don't even know yet might be false. And then those are sort of moved forward with great perseverance, our effort. How is it when subject and object are unified? Faith mind says, make the slightest distinction and heaven and earth are worlds apart. But if they are fundamentally one nature, how can they be split apart? How can one simple distinction do that? Here, only the flag waving in the wind knows. That's the thing. So we can't know from back here. We can come up with all kinds of theories and elegant solutions to the argument. We cannot care. We can think this has nothing to do with me or my life and be wrong. But if we want to understand, if we recognize that that flag waving in the wind is my health, is my aging, is my death, if what's waving in the wind is my mind or my confidence or my trust in you or the world, if what's waving in the wind is my government or my country or my earth, then maybe it'll get my attention. Then I might be motivated to look a little closer. Because within samsara, everything's flapping in the wind. See, that's the thing. The question is, what is it, just the nature to flap and wave about? What is making it move? Is it the thing itself? Is there some force? Am I just an objective observer? The three worlds are mind. Is that possible? It seems inconceivable. Do I understand what that means? And so we turn inward to find out. Looking from a distance, it does seem obvious. The flag is moving because of the wind. The wind has its own force. The flag is being acted upon. What's to ask? Coming closer, it's sort of like standing back from Zazen, looking at somebody sitting. And you say, why are you doing this? And they say, well, I really want to see things as they are. I want to experience my life in the moment in which it's taking place. And I want to understand what is that? So I can live at peace and be in harmony and be a benefit in the world. And they say, why do you make it so complicated? Just get about your life. Just do things. Huainung said, good friends, in this teaching, from ancient times up to the present, all the great teachers have presented no mind as the main teaching, no form as the essence, and non-abiding as the basis. No mind is to realize the emptiness of thoughts when involved in thought. No form is to be free from things even when being in the midst of things. And non-abiding is simply your original nature. The commentary begins, it's neither the wind nor the flag nor the mind that's moving. And that's referring to an event that happened many years later, some years later, 100 years or so later, where there were a group of students who were monastics who were traveling, going to meet a teacher that they wanted to study with, and that they stayed up during the snowstorm at a monastery. And in that monastery, there was the nun, Miaozhen, who was a student of Yangshan's, and this was the monastery of Yangshan. And he had appointed her the director of the guest house, which was considered a very significant role, an important position. And so these 17 monastics who were on the road that night were debating this whole encounter between Huainung and these two monastics and the flag, and were working out that question. And Miaozhen was sitting outside listening to them. And she said, how wasteful. How many pairs of straw sandals have these 17 blind donkeys worn out? They haven't even dreamed of Buddha Dharma. And her Jisha let them know what she had said. It's a little bit of theater here. Let her know what was happening. And instead of being upset, this is all drawing from a fascicle of Dogen's. Instead of being upset with her disapproval, they were ashamed of their lack of understanding. And they put on their formal robes, and they went to her and offered incense and bowed and asked for a teaching. And she said, come closer. And when they got still closer, Miaozhen said, it's not the wind that flaps. It's not the banner that flaps. It is your mind that flaps. And it said, Dogen said, that hearing her words, all of the monastics had realization. They thanked her, and then they asked to become her students. Dogen says, thus, even nowadays, when the position of abbot or head monastic is not filled, you should request a nun who has attained Dharma to assume the position. However aged or senior a monastic may be, what's the use of someone who has not attained the way? The master in an assembly should be a person of a clear eye. He goes on to say, why are men special? Emptiness is emptiness. The four great elements are the four great elements. Five skandhas are the five skandhas. Women are just like this. Men are just like this. Both women and men attain the way. You should honor attainment of the way. Do not discriminate between men and women. This is the most wondrous principle of the Buddha way. And I would say amen to that. And then invoking another old master, I would say, I pray that we live it. I pray that we live it. And this point that Dogen is making is not apart from the koan, is not apart from this question of the flag in the wind. What is the nature of self and things? I didn't understand the importance of that question in the beginning of my practice. I really didn't. It seemed abstract and very sort of philosophical or theoretical. It did not land in me in a way that I understood. What I understood was my pain, my suffering, my confusion, my sense that there was another way of living my life, my wanting to have a life that was fulfilled and purposeful. I wanted to die without regret, which meant I had to live without regret. There were many things I was aware of, but the sense of the question of the nature of myself was distant. But I encountered it over and over and over again in the teachings of my teacher, in the teachings of the Dharma. It was like I couldn't trace from that question to things, what I felt so keenly. I didn't understand, how does that question, the nature of self, relate to what this very direct, tangible experience I'm having within my life? I didn't see a link. Right? And in a way, that's okay. Right? It's okay. There's not even a link because they're not even different. That's the thing. And I say it's okay because if we practice sincerely, we will see. We will begin to encounter that our understanding and begin to understand why the question of the nature of the self is the ultimate question in Buddhism. And Buddhism being ultimately about liberating the self has everything and only to do with everything that we experience. And so this question, is it the flag or is it the wind, in a way is a very, very profoundly skillful way of asking. And it's a subtle way of asking because we could look at it and say, what's the connection? Who cares? Right? And the interesting thing about koan study, if you're doing koan training and you encounter this koan and you sort of have that response like, you have to find a way in. In a way, you have to find that place within you that does begin to understand and care. Otherwise, there's no way that this can help us to reveal ourselves to ourselves. And if it asked it in a more direct or obvious or sort of, you know, relatable way, initially, that might seem skillful because we'd bite into it. We'd chew on it. Find lots to chew on. There'd be a lot of meat on that bone. There'd be a lot of sponginess in that tofu. But then what? Would we really be biting on the essential question, or would we just be eating the fruits of our conditioned mind and our karma that already knows all this stuff? That's why the koans are spoken of as being flavorless. Right? Like a hammerhead with no hold. It's like, how do you hold on to this thing? You don't. You don't. That's the thing. Now there's a door that's open. The mind of the great sage of India was intimately conveyed from west to east. Among human beings are wise ones and fools. We see examples of that everywhere. But in the way, there is no northern or southern ancestor. There is no sudden or gradual enlightenment. There is no male or female or non-binary. There is no white or black or brown. and the tremendous, sometimes painful, hard to trust ask of the Buddha Dharma is that we have to work through all of that, what we call our identities, to get to the place where we realize what Dogen is speaking about, what the poem we chanted this morning is pointing to, that is the source of our liberation, so that we can then open our eyes again and inhabit what those identities are based in, those characteristics, those qualities, now freely and knowingly and at ease and with each other. I was reading a poem by Tracy Smith, who is the poet laureate several years ago. It's called Ash. Strange house we must keep and fill, house that eats and pleads and kills, house on legs, house on fire, house infested with desire, haunted house, lonely house, house of trick and suck and shrug. Give it to me, house. I need you, baby, house. House whose rooms are pooled with blood, house with hands, house of guilt, house that other houses built, house of lies and pride and bone, house afraid to be alone, house like an engine that churns and stalls, house with skin and hair for walls, house the seasons singe and douse, house that believes it's not a house. It's not the wind, it's not the flag, it's not your mind. The wind is flapping. Where do you find yourself? Where is that action? Is it in here? Is it out there? What does that have to do with every waking moment? With every action that we take? As long as anything comes to rest in one place, that one place eventually becomes a place of sorrow and pain. As long as something comes to rest in one place, that place can never ultimately be unhindered. And being hindered, it raises unnecessary worry and concern. This is what helps us to raise bodhicitta. And so Huainong said, no mind is to realize the emptiness of thoughts within a thought. No form is to be free from things, even when relating to things. So how to be free in that simple moment of seeing a flag wave in the wind? The slightest distinction separates heaven and earth. Being separated, there will be trouble. You know, we can think of our thoughts as sentient beings, things. Objects. Buddhism thinks of them exactly this way, as objects. And so you've got some sentient beings in your mind. Some of them are happy. Some of them are sad. Some of them are big. Some of them are small. Some of them are very powerful. Some of them are very weak, dim. Some are just being born. Some are dying. And when we practice, what we're practicing is not imprisoning those many beings. Right? Because what happens if you take a whole bunch of beings and you throw them in prison? You got to take care of them. Right? Now they're your responsibility. You may not take care of them well. You have to feed them, you have to give them water, you have to. Lots and lots of energy. When you let them free, they take care of themselves. And when the mind, when those sent many beings within our mind are set free, the mind is set free. And then when the mind is set free, we realize the universe is free. Everything we saw and looked at as false, we now realize is true. Before, everything we looked at and thought was true is true. The flapping wind, the flag in mind seem to distract us. Right? This koan itself might seem to be distracting. This talk might seem to be distracting. And something may be more or less skillful, maybe more direct or less direct, maybe clear and obscure, but obstruction doesn't happen out there. Nothing has that kind of power. How are we using our minds? Non-abiding, Huainong said, is your original nature. You can't know it, you can't grasp it, you can't hold it, you can't figure it out. And I know we all think, we all have our moments where we think, I'm going to figure this out. Right? I'm good at figuring things out. I'm going to figure this out. I remember thinking that and then thinking, okay, big guy, but even if you did, what would you have? Like, you would have figured something out and you would just have more figuring. Do you really trust that? How is it that we can in one moment move freely and in the next moment be bound? We can have deep insight that really changes our way of seeing things, and then we can forget that and act out of our own false views. We can break a habit and seem to have interrupted it, and then there it appears again. Bill Waldron, in his teachings on Yogacara, says afflictions do persist even, and this is a very old question in Buddhism, pretty much as old as Buddhism itself. How do we account for that? That kind of sense of discontinuity. So Bill says, afflictions do persist even while they are being gradually purified. That is, the process of liberation requires that both the gradually weakened afflictions, which means all of our habit patterns and false views and the cycles that keep us entrenched, that requires that both the gradually weakened afflictions as well as one's gradually strengthening virtues be present in the mind stream at the same time, despite their seemingly opposing karmic qualities. And I added in seemingly. They seem to oppose each other, and that is why they continue to seem to oppose each other, because they seem to. This situation is exacerbated by the great gulf between the mundane nature of our ordinary mind that prepares for and cultivates such extraordinary meditative states, in other words, all that we bring into practice, and the supramundane nature of the meditative states themselves, that which cannot be described. Not to mention the frequent alternation between them that constitutes spiritual practice over time, falling down, standing up, moving forward, sliding backwards. For although one may have a life-altering insight into reality, one still returns to a decidedly mundane world, attending to ordinary affairs, which are laden in our mind with history and memories and associations and habit patterns. Nevertheless, the tradition from very early on claimed that one stream of mind, or citta, has been inalterably affected, and one is now more disposed to have such insights again. And this is very important, that practice begins to set up a positive, what we call a positive feedback loop, in the same way that samsara does the same thing, but in samsara. And so when we practice, we are creating an inalterable effect on our mind stream, and mind stream means the whole thing, that predisposes us more and more and more towards that very thing, the Dharma, the path, compassion, loving kindness, concentration, mindfulness, all of the things that we're developing. He says the antidotes to these afflictions, whose predispositions permeate our subliminal processes, All of those, how we're predisposed to act out of our habits, to have those thoughts again, the same thoughts again, to react in the same way, can coexist with the predispositions towards enlightenment. Right? Much like medicine coexists in the same body that harbors the disease it acts upon. And then he says, that's really a good analogy. For medicine to carry out its effect, it needs to be in the body at the same time as the disease. Right? So now in our time when the world is being vaccinated, right, where people may or may not have COVID, and we're taking in that medicine, which is also the illness, that may or may not exist at the same time in the same body as the illness itself, that heals us, protects us. He says, Indian philosophers have traditionally pointed out the limits of reflexivity, that is, the eye cannot see itself, a knife cannot cut itself, and have used this argument to argue that the mind cannot know itself. And then he says, but this assumes that the mind is a singular thing, a well-bounded entity, that it is a thing. In other words, that argument is based on the assumption that we know what mind is, and it is something. But we readily accept that the body can heal itself because we recognize that the body is just a name for a complex conglomeration of many different interacting systems which each affect each other in various ways. And none of them are you. It's a strange house we must keep and fill. House like an engine that churns and stalls, house with skin and hair for walls, house that seasons singe and douse, house that believes it's not a house. So I think of that how in the beginning of practice, as we begin to see ourselves as, no, I'm not that. That's not, I don't think that way. I don't have that belief. So I'm going to have to just push that one away. That's not me. And then as we practice and we begin to realize, we begin to inhabit this house and inhabit it peacefully. Accept this house. Because everyone's got one. And we've all had a hand in building each other's house. Now in that peace, now we can see the house clearly. Now at peace, we can look at the flag waving and see it beyond the surface, beyond the appearance, see it within our own mind. And so in order to actually realize the point of this, the student has to actually take the flag waving into their mind. But they don't have to take a step to do that because it's already there. That is the only way they can know that it's waving. It's already their mind. Now, they're just turning their attention to it, to the place where it is flapping. And it begins to appear strangely, right? Not like before. We realize it's not a house at all. And now we can be quite at peace there. So in the commentary, Wu Men says that although the ancestor could not repress his compassion, that he made an awkward scene. And this is a way of both praising his willingness to do that and just acknowledging it's awkward because in order to, in a sense, attend to the suffering within samsara, we have to be within the samsara. That we have to employ the very instruments of our confusion and pain to alleviate that confusion and pain. There's no other way. And the more we see that, the more awkward it is. That's why it said if the teacher talks too much, it's so awkward that their eyebrows fall out. Right? Just they die of awkwardness. In the poem, he says, the wind moves, the flag moves, the mind moves, all of them missed it. Though he knows how to open his mouth, he does not see. He was caught by words. So it's interesting how the koan, first, it's not the flag, it's not the wind, and the student sees that. And now it's not the flag, it's not the wind, it's not the mind. Has to see that. The Huenung knew how to open his mouth. He doesn't know that he was caught by words. I think he does. I think Wu Men is saying this for our benefit. How easy it is to be caught. And so that's why it's important that we develop our mindfulness and our concentration and be diligent about that and really practice well. You know, I've been talking to a lot of students who've been, you know, as they continue practicing so much at home and in isolation and in the winter, which is tough for a lot of people, and seeing sometimes things fall apart a little bit. And I've talked to a number of students who have said, you know, I think I need to create a little bit more structure. And I just recently said to somebody, I've said, you know, I've met some students who sort of practice without any structure in their lives and do okay, but actually I can't remember any of them. I'm just saying that for, you know, the statistics, right? The fact that there are some people who might be able to practice like that. But pretty generally, we need that. We need, that's why we live a fairly, what Buddhism calls a disciplined life. Discipline, which means in this sense, we know what's important and we know what we need to do to put that at the center of our attention and to follow through on that so that that blossoms, that is brought out. That if it is left vague and amorphous, then it tends to just float in vagary and amorphousness. And so to have clarity about this day, about how we are going to bring forth our intention, bring forth our energy, practice our mind, then we are quite likely to do that. Not in every moment, but we are quite likely to do that in many moments, and that will just increase because we are establishing that disposition, right? Those energies, those patterns, right, are being strengthened and developed and made more effortless and natural. Just seems to be the way things work. Dogen says, Shakyamuni Buddha saw Mahakaya Shapa in person. After all, that's it. To see yourself in person, to see each other in person. Thus, the authentic ancestors of all generations have continued face-to-face transmission, disciple seeing teacher, teacher seeing disciple. It is like pouring water into the ocean and spreading it endlessly. In that, it is not just disciple seeing teacher and teacher seeing disciple. It is seeing all beings, the many beings, like the ocean spreading endlessly, or like transmitting a lamp and allowing it to shine forever. In thousands of millions of transmissions, the trunk and branches are one, like breaking an eggshell by pecking from the inside and outside at once. And so that flag waving, when the mind becomes ripe and attuned, is pecking on your shell and transmitting the great inquiry is us pecking from the inside. And then the whole world and people and friends and strangers and teachers And all aspects of practice become this ongoing concert, this symphony. Peck, 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 tap, tap, peck, peck.
Thanks for listening. Did you know that Zen Mountain Monastery is live streaming all Dharma talks and daily Zazen during the coronavirus quarantine? Visit our website to learn about all the online programs being offered at this time. Just go to zmm.org and click on the link at the very top of the page, or scroll down and click on Retreats.